Hello, 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 and welcome to the final episode of coverage on the 77th edition of the Cannes Film Festival. I'm Eliana.
And I'm Patrick. Hi.
And today on Conversations, we have someone who's been here a couple of times before, Öykü Sofuoğlu.
Hello, hello.
How's it going?
I'm fine. I'm super excited to be on this podcast again. It's always a pleasure to talk to you guys.
As it is for us. Today, we'll try to talk about some of the festival finale in competition films, such as The Grand Tour by Miguel Gomez, All We Imagine as Light, Payal Kapadia, and Anora, which, as people might know by now, is the Palme d'Or winner by Sean Baker. We'll also try to talk about some other things too, but I was wondering, how did the festival end for both of you?
Maybe we should say that today is the 31st of May, so we did have some distance to the festival, geographic as well as temporal. That means we maybe have a clearer vision of what this festival was like for us and how it compares to previous years. To me, I'm still rather on the pessimistic side. I think the festival, especially in the second week, did have some standouts, but I think it does not really compare to especially the rather strong edition of last year. But I will say toward the end, I was, rather reconciled with the festival because I was just longing for the good movies to come in. And they did come toward the end. So if I were to decide, I would rather take this sort of dramaturgy than the other way around. So what did you think, Öykü?
I mean, I felt like when we were having these past editions, we weren't aware of the fact that they were really good selections. And now looking back, not just last year, the previous years, post-pandemic, because I feel like people were having their films kept aside. And now we watched all these beautiful films and now we're just stuck with these, I don't know, really mediocre selection, especially in the competition. I was quite also disappointed by the films. And I kind of blame myself maybe being too cynical or too, especially in the first week, I was like, maybe I'm being too harsh. But after speaking like many others and hearing and seeing them feeling the same way, I was a bit, so everyone is thinking as the way I do. But at the same time, I feel like the festival just floated somehow. Like I wasn't really present. Maybe the spirit of the festival wasn't really present this year. I think I was talking about this to Eliana during the last days. And I feel like it's just happened, but I wasn't really present. Maybe only screenings I was really enjoying and like in mindfully watching the film was probably Godard and Leos Carax. And other than that, I was more maybe Jiachanke and Miguel Gomez, but otherwise I was just like being too distanced vis-a-vis what I was watching.
No, I understand that. I feel I also very much enjoyed the Carax, C'est pas moi, which was in the special screening section, I believe. And I find this at some point too, like I told you during the festival, I just was sort of floating through it and making it to some screenings here and there and saw some of the special classics restored. I saw Wim Wenders, Paris, Texas for the first time. And it was just almost like I just let the festival towards the end rock me through the screenings. Even though when I look back, I can say, oh, there were quite a few films that I appreciated very much, but I also did not target a lot of the quinzaine des cinéastes, Un Certain Regard or Semaine de la Critique films that I believe both of you might have seen many more of.
But I think it's always a pleasure to discover these films that you couldn't watch during Cannes. And it's, mm-hmm. I mean, for me, it's always a pleasure because, of course, you can't see, watch everything. And after the festival, when all these hectic period passes and you discover in other instances, other festivals or other situations, these beautiful films. And I appreciate more when it's out of Cannes.
Yeah, and but I must say this year it's not as, you know, as much of a stain to me than in previous years where I had missed films at the festival and then I thought, oh my God, no, I should have seen that. This year I don't feel like that. There are a few titles where I think, yeah, I wouldn't mind catching that in the next few months. But I do remember, for instance, last year I didn't get to see Los Delincuentes. And, you know, I only caught up with this year and it was incredible. And I think, wow, had I seen that last year, I would probably also have ended up on my top list and everything. I really loved that film. This year, I don't get the same sense that I missed so many films. But yeah, in general, I was also thinking about if we can talk, perhaps to give maybe listeners also an idea of how our days are structured in Cannes and maybe how many films we see overall. Like, because I think we're so short-sighted sometimes on, you know, how how we build our schedules and which films to catch, and then we don't really like get this outsider perspective that to which it must seem quite strange to see so many films. And I was wondering, Erku, do you have an idea how many films you saw throughout the festival, and yeah, how many then you saw per day?
I mean, I might have cheated a bit because of the press screenings in Paris. So some of them I saw it before festival started. Overall, like from the whole selection, I think it's more than 40, 41, 43, something like that. But in general, I think I start the day, my day, with a Kenzan film in the morning and the 8:30 screenings. And then in general, I think there's an Un Certain Regard film in between, but I prefer to write in between the competition and the first Kenzan film I watch in the morning. And later, there's either a special screening at, it's a competition film at 3, 4-ish, or 2. And then there's another competition or either a special screening in between, I think my program is more packed in the afternoon and in the evening, and the morning I try to spend time writing because you're also more fresh in the morning. But at the same time, the negative aspect of this program is that in the afternoon I feel tired. And maybe that's why, like for some of the films especially, I did this with the Crimes of the Future too. I was going to watch Cronenberg in the late night screening during its premiere, and I felt super tired, and I was like, no, I'm gonna do this tomorrow morning. And after some point I realized that I couldn't keep this schedule, so I started going to the Théâtre Lumière or Agnès Varda screenings the day after, since I didn't have any deadlines or like people writing for trades. I kind of messed up. I think everyone probably experienced the same thing during the last days, because you try to catch as many films as possible and it becomes too messy. And it depends also on the ticketing system. Yeah, I think overall it was like that for me.
And did you also keep track of how many pieces you've written over the festival?
Oh boy, yeah. I think it's, for now, it's 11. It's too much. And it's in 3 languages, Turkish, French, and English. So I don't know, it's too much. I feel like it's not a healthy rhythm.
Yes. And how about you, Eliana? How many films did you
Oh, goodness. See. I think I also saw around 40 films, also with the aid of some screeners. And I don't know. I feel like I had 2 days where I just did nothing. Screenless days in the middle of Cannes. I wasn't feeling very good. Unfortunately, there's something that goes around at some point. Everyone is a cacophony of coughing in the theaters, and you wonder, oh goodness, have I been targeted by someone? And I often like to see the classics or the restored if I can. It's very easy to get into those screenings, and then I spend a lot of my days in the cineum, and I have the lightest of you two because I just sort of help do this co-hosting for conversations, but we shall see and plot little things for the future and little things that seem to stand out and come out in terms of understanding like what certain imagery or themes that reoccur. I don't know. For me, the imagery of a man being superimposed with a bird's face came up on multiple occasions, either in the shorts or through various different from the Napoleon of Abel Gance to a short in the Philippines factory section of the director's Fortnight, Bird by Andrea Arnold. And this theme of men and birds was just something that I like to notice. Overall, the schedules are, I just take it in a very relaxed way. If I get too, then I will fall asleep too often in screenings, or I'll just feel overwhelmed. And how lovely it is to know that you have a ticket perhaps to 3 or 4 in competition films, but it's exhausting sometimes, as you said about the Cronenberg last year or the year before, to just try to go and see it. And then you realize, no, I don't think I have the bandwidth for that. And then in terms of finding films, often I rely on the beautiful advice of those around me who say, this one you should see. This one you can see later if you're interested. And it was that way that I saw the new Alain Giraudy, Misericordia, which was very much to my liking as something very fresh. And then Good One by India Donaldson, which also was at Sundance this past year. And in this tempo, it's things liberate themselves, tickets liberate themselves. Perhaps I'm doing something wrong, but I just think, oh no, it will appear. It will appear, something will happen. And if I miss it now, I'll see it at another point in time. And yourself?
Yeah, I mean, for someone like you, Eliana, who's partly based in Paris as well, this is more easily said, right? Because you can catch up with many of the films that play in Cannes that may not ever make it even overseas.
It's true.
About this bird thing, I was also thinking of last year's Eureka, you know, where the bird was sort of a conveyor of, or a means of traveling through, I don't know, consciousness and time. And Eureka and Close Your Eyes by Victor Erice, these two films were also much of a debate last year because they didn't feature in competition. And this, I think I was reminded of that discussion this year because there is, for instance, the film you just mentioned, Eliana, the Alain Giraudy, Misericordia. Just because, you know, his last film did play, that there was Rester Vertical or Staying Vertical, that played in competition 2016. I think it's perhaps his first film since then. And I was just wondering about how the competition comes about, you know, the competition titles. That is a thing we have discussed before on this podcast, but I'm a bit confused as to how they justify the decisions they make. We have this Coralie Fajar film, The Substance, which I found as a midnight screening would have fit much better than in competition, whereas the Giraudy film, which I found much stronger, was in this Cannes premiere section as the Victor Erice and the Lisandro Alonso film last year. And at this point, it's hard for me to, wrap my head around the decision-making there. I did see only 17 of 22 competition films. And I think that is, you know, that is the product of learning over years, because you do get a sense of which competition films you can just sort of skip. You also hear, so sometimes I wait, you know, sometimes I miss purposefully the first screening, and then I see how the reaction is, and usually I don't know, my initial feeling about these films is right. And yeah, so I was wondering if you have any, you know, if you have any idea about that, Erku. What do you think at this point makes for a competition film? We also have the Emilia Perez, right, that we have really ignored on this podcast too, because I only heard bad things from the people I trust, so I didn't really pay attention to that.
Just to correct something, Alain Giraudy also had a film in Berlinale, in Panorama last year, Vien Jotaman, in between. But in Cannes, I mean, his presence in Cannes, yes, I think we can say that it's quite like a gap between these films. And regarding competition, and also to justify, it's not justify, but why I watch all these competition films, it's because all these jury grids or the grid obsession of giving stars was kind of really present for me this year. So I was kind of... I felt obliged to watch as many competitions as films as possible, because me too, I know what I like. I know what it's bad. Like for example, last year there was a Sean Penn film. I know that it's bad. So why bother watching it? But about the selection, I think what they try to do, at least what Thierry Frémaux tries to do, is kind of prove that he's being progressive. And because I think I heard something about like a Coralie Forget's film being in the competition, somebody said this film wouldn't be in competition in like 10 years ago. So I think this trying to see we're like having a genre film in the competition. See, there's a film by an exiled filmmaker. So all these themes, like there's a queer film that also won the Queer Palm, Romanian film. And look, there's a first feature, this Diamant Brut. So all these films kind of try to justify, like we're kind of trying to ticking the boxes. And that's, I think, how Thierry Frémaux's mind work. But I'm not so sure, of course. And for Emilia Perez, I don't want to say much, because on Twitter, I was attacked by Selena Gomez fans a lot. So it's a complete different level of fan base for that film. And I'm afraid for the future. And but I think especially what I found really interesting in the competition was Rasulov's film. Because, I mean, I don't want to be bitter or cynical about this, but of course, he's an important filmmaker, we accept. But I think the way his new film was treated was a bit... over exaggerated comparing to, like, after watching the film, I was like, so people were cheering for this film?
I didn't
vocalize this much, because there's always this fresh, like when people watch a film for the first time, some people become super hyped about it, and I don't trust their reactions. And that's basically what happened with Rasulov. And I saw all these reviews like celebrating, and then it was kind of like a green border in Venice. I don't know if you remember that. After the screening, everyone was, oh, such a powerful film about Europe, and I was like really fearing that it would won the Golden Lion, but it didn't at the end, right. And I was people were criticizing, oh, they didn't give anything to Rasulov. But I think, like, if you watch the film, if you see the material, I mean, it's evident. It's a well-justified prize.
Well, and I do remember this green border thing, because I remember that I wrote on that film, and I think the German magazine for which I wrote the piece was not happy that my review was so negative on that one. Because, you know, in all the festival, I think it just that sometimes this idea of being politically aligned is stronger than to make out for aesthetic assessments. But Yeah, in any case, I mean, I think that also naturally leads us to a transition into the festival politics, which I think we cannot just glisten over. I think we have to talk about that a little bit, especially because I think Cannes is such a strong contrast to Berlin, for instance. In Berlin this year, of course, there was even more pertinent than in previous years because we have Israel's attacks on Gaza still going on. We had actually of the penultimate day of the festival, we had the order of the international court that said that Israel had to stop the attacks. But there are some low-key conspiracies going on that this list, you know, this Me Too list that did not materialize at the end. We talked about it on our first episode, I think, that mm-hmm. was supposed to feature big names of the French film industry and how they were involved in Me Too, like scandals, like sexual harassments and so on. But there are some voices out there who say, oh, yeah, due to all that focus, we never at all addressed the conflict in Gaza. And I think the only thing I really saw in that respect was this dress that Cate Blanchett wore on the red carpet, which, she lifted part of it and then it became a Palestine flag, basically. But apart from that, I hardly heard anything about that conflict. So there was so much less present here. Of course, in Berlin, it's a bit of a different context. The festival is more well-known as a political festival. And of course, there was this whole Strike Germany or Boycott Germany movement as well. But yeah, I've found it weirdly absent here. And I was wondering if you have heard anything more than I have. And there was also the strike, they announced the strike of the workers affiliated with the festival who are often low-tier contract workers, seasonal workers who don't get social benefits and so on. And I did see there was one Deadline report, and on there's this photo and this short video clip where you see a little banner on the over-large festival poster. And So they did hijack that for like 20 seconds or so on the day of the opening ceremony, and then it was never mentioned again. So yeah, a lot of things that were, announced beforehand, and then nothing really materialized.
I mean, I feel like Cannes is always about this build up about scandals. Every year there's something before the festival starts and people talk about it. Yeah, this year it's going to be like a huge blast about something. Like, I don't remember what was it last year, but anyway, like Thierry Frémaux says something weird and then people just over comment and then it becomes like a huge thing. But when the festival starts, it's just like it disappears completely because everyone is more concerned about red carpets, premieres. And I think it was basically what happened as well this year. But what I found really outrageous was the opening. I don't, I haven't listened to the first episode. I'm sorry if you already talked about this, but the fact that they programmed Judith Godrèche film in the Ansartan Regards opening while having Quentin Dupieux's film for the official competition is like a, it's such a, like a middle finger to the, all these discourse about Me Too, about the cancel culture. And I think that was like seeing these films like premiering at the same day was like, yeah, why, what we were expecting. Like it's such a cynical way to approach all these subjects. And I think that kind of created a really like a cold water on my face about my expectations on the festival. And I'm going to talk about the strike first, because I feel like when there's a strike in the film industry, if it doesn't concern the actors, directors, it's so hard to make it visible with regards to other people and to walk a lot, to make it more vocal in the whole all these big atmosphere where you have film market, where you have premieres. And I think that's basically what happened. Like there was a strike going on, but it just stayed in the background. I also saw, for example, Miguel Gomez press conference. I think after winning the award, he had a badge or something in front of him about the strikes. Like these small gestures that we appreciate when a director or an actor does, but overall it just stays such a minimal gesture. And I think, like, if you want to skip the Gaza situation, that's always the debate, right? When an individual celebrity does something, is it worth the mention or praise? Because it's the minimal thing they can do in the situation, right? And everyone was talking about Cate Blanchett. I think it's a valid discussion I value both opinions because she, as a star, she makes it visible, but at the same time, at what cost? Like, what does it contribute to the representation, to conflict? I don't know, but I think it's a valid discussion to talk about these more visible but less impactful gestures. And I think there was also either Bella Hadid or Gigi Hadid who wore a keffiyeh dress. Yeah, okay, I understand. It creates a debate, but is it just a debate that exists only in our bubbles and doesn't necessarily have an impact on the overall situation? I think yes. And about the films, as you said, Berlinale and Germany has a different political context, and it kind of escalated to a big crisis. Whereas in Cannes, I think people had, as I had in the beginning of the festival, such a cynical, like everyone knows how cynical and a political calm is. And the only thing they can do is, I think, to have politically problematic filmmakers in the competition. That's the only thing they can do. And as many years before, I think with Serebrennikov or Loznitsa, or this year with Rasulov, this is the only, I think, thing they allow to happen. And but I don't know. I also think maybe I'm being too speculative about this, but since there's all these preparations for Olympics, I think French people were quite strict about the overall organization of the festival. I don't know if you realize it, but the security checks were definitely more aggressive and strict than previous years, even more aggressive than I think the post-pandemic year. And maybe it was also related to that, this context of more, general context of France was also had an impact on the festival's potential disruptions.
Yeah, and I think this year they had a record number of attendees as well. So there was really, as you say, it felt even more of a police state than in previous years, because they were just also too many people really on the Croisette, which is not a very wide, you know, avenue. It gets thinner and thinner, especially as the day goes on and they block major parts of the avenue. But do you have any thoughts on the political aspects of the festival, Eliana?
I think with everything, it's always so very difficult. I think France is a hub of culture and language, etc. But at the same time, it's very much at the root of it. It's a massive hypocrisy. And that shows up in so many different aspects, like from if you just see this idea of what is France doing to prepare for the Olympics, how, and all the things that you mentioned as well. Like there's something about, oh, making the veneer of things look pretty, always keeping up appearances. There are always going to be these contradictions, and I really contradictions, but it's not funny, but I really don't know either. When one takes to making these fashion statements, as you both mentioned, and these are statements because perhaps the word is not even sufficient enough to try to use to make a stance or to combat I think the ideas of it's all so difficult to navigate. And I think I also have difficulty understanding where to stand or where to what to think, because whatever truth is, even our appearance and going to these festivals, like, it does put a bitter taste in your mouth. I mean, they had a film that was just on the Olympics, I think, at Cannes as well. I didn't go to see it. On the other hand, one can say, has anything really changed in terms of the invitation of chaos and the perhaps false ideas of inviting some form of presence or discourse by inviting filmmakers whose films are contentious or the backgrounds of political drama? I don't really know. And in terms of Godrèche and Me Too, and also the fact that this Dupieux film, for example, can be viewed as very, very offensive as well. It depends also on how you look at it. I can't say anything because I'm often not able to, but I'm really not sure. I don't think I will really be able to talk more in a way that's helpful on this.
I think there's truth in what you say about that these gestures sometimes might end up being, you know, more effective than anything else. Because if you think about it, Cannes is a festival about images, and the image of Cate Blanchett lifting her dress might be of a much greater impact than words that easily go amiss in the overall conversation. Yeah, I think then we should perhaps transition to the movies, right? Of which we do have a good selection today. We have a few films that actually won a few important awards at the festival. And perhaps why not start with Miguel Gomez, or Gomez. I never looked that up, how to pronounce his name. But yeah, his newest film, Grand Tour, won the Director's Award at Cannes. Gomez is a very interesting filmmaker, I think. We are currently in Porto, Eliana and I, and he's from Portugal. And he had this, some people might say, magnus opus, magnum opus, Arabian Nights, the trilogy in 2015. Then he took a while off until he came back with the Tsugua Diaries in 2021. I must say, I haven't seen these films yet. I have only seen Taboo, which, you know, turned out in retrospect as perhaps the right thing to do, because there are a lot of links to Taboo, I feel. Taboo was a Luz Murnau adaptation / homage from 2012. And yeah, the Grand Tour, it has actually historic precedent. There were a lot of European travelers at the beginning of the 20th century who went on this so-called Grand Tour that meant a journey through Asia, Southeast Asia, probably in particular. And such a tour we see here as well. It's an historical fiction that is mixed with footage that Gomez took in 2020 when he went on this grand tour himself, sort of to, yeah, preempt his character's journey. And yeah, this footage at the beginning is sort of interwoven with the embedded plot, but later it becomes much less binary and it becomes all more conflated. And what kind of story do we have here? At the center is Edward Abbott. He's an officer for the British Empire and stationed in Malaya in British Burma at the time, which nowadays would be known as Myanmar. And yeah, he gets cold feet at the brink of his wedding. He sees the steamboat of his fiancée, Molly, emerge on the horizon. And we don't really get insights into his inner thoughts, but yeah, he doesn't feel up to the challenge of marriage at the time. So, and he flees and embarks on this grand tour through different countries. And it's quite a fascinating film. I saw it the first time and I was a bit underwhelmed, but I also was very tired at the time. And I thought, oh, I didn't do the film justice, you know, by being only halfway, only having my half attention on the film. And then I saw it again, which is a treat, you know. Every now and then you get the chance to do that at a film festival if you're really convinced of a film. And it was quite rewarding, I must say. I think it's perhaps my favorite film of the festival. And we then see Molly, his fiancée, you know, trying to track him down. And she's very determined and also very cheerful about it. You know, she's not... She doesn't feel refused by him. She rather takes it as a challenge. And yeah, it's a film I found actually quite heartfelt as well, quite endearing. And yeah, perhaps Erku, take us on the grand tour yourself. What did you think?
I Gomesh, for me, especially with Arabian Nights, is a really... It's a filmmaker I admire a lot, and I love, especially in narrative films, this kind of deviation, like going out of context. It's a trope that I really enjoy, both in literature and then I mean you also, Patrick, probably like this a lot, and this idea of deviation in narrative. And I also like the meta cinema aspect that he also had in Suka Diaries. And I mean, I think I've been waiting for this film for a long time, because we know that he was working on a film, but because of the pandemics, he had to stop. So I was really, really excited for this film. And I think I'm quite rewarded as well, like you said. And I don't think the need of watching the film again is a negative thing. Like sometimes there are these films that you want to watch it again just to discover more, just to like dig deeper, because once you get the general feeling of it, you want to explore it more. I think another film I experienced the same feeling was The Beast. You get the general picture in the first watch, and then you want to go back and see other things more. I think it's like a touristic expedition as well, which also the film makes reference to. Like you go to a country, you see it for the first time, and then you want to dig deeper, right? Then that's, I think, what Grand Tour does. You just want to keep traveling inside the film. And by the way, it's an interesting point about the name. I learned that Grand Tour was actually meant to qualify the voyages in Europe. It's traveling across the Europe. So I think there's an aspect of inverse Orientalism, maybe. So because I'm still thinking about this Orientalist aspect of the film that it tries to tackle by adding these voiceover narration, where in every country that Edward travels, it's narrated by a native speaker of that country. And I think there are several things on visual level as well. We see a lot of shadow puppets or different forms proper to that culture. And I think the film itself tries to address this Orientalist gaze from which it's inevitable to escape. Because there's also the characters are speaking to each other in Portuguese. All these language, culture and visual representations of the culture kind of creates a network of signs. And I also found it this really interesting. But at the same time, I really like the idea of being dragged by the filmmaker and being surprised all the time about the images that you're seeing. Like when you're watching a film, let's say it's a narrative film, you kind of have an idea of how it's going to turn out, right? Whereas in Gomesh's films, you're always surprised and where film will drag you. And I think it's also an Arabian Nights as well. There's a, I'm not going to spoil it for the people who haven't watched it, but it's just like so surprising as an experience. And I think what I enjoyed the most in Grand Tour was that surprise and just letting yourself go to a film without having any preconceived narrative expectations, like seeing something and saying like in your mind, okay, now he's going to do that. Nah, 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 nah. And then like constructing the film in your mind, even before watching it, this how it will end up. But whereas here, it feels like you're in the mind of an ADHD person, and it just drags you all over the place. And I like that chaos, but it's a contained chaos. Yeah.
I definitely like what you say about this. I feel in so many ways this film, going back to the theme of floating and being carried, but also, as you said, being dragged by the filmmaker. And there's something at its core, which I haven't seen his previous works, but at its core deals for me with returning to a naivete of discovery of a place and marvel. And this, of course, has also become in, I suppose, modern discourse, like to look at Orientalism or to look at colonization, the colonialism, as a problematic thing. But here somehow I wonder if we are able to, if his cinema in this shifts that back to the plain simplicity of discovery, which is a very big conversation to have. I don't know if I'm ready to have it right now, but I find that that was very intriguing for me. Because the grand tour that you mentioned of Europe of the 18th century was this exploration of, it was important for artists or literary figures or philosophers to go to Rome and to go to Paris and to go to see all these ancient sites of, or I mean, particularly Rome, and to see like the ancient antiquity and to learn from what they had studied in the older, in the books of the philosophers, etc. And it's sort of implied that a similar thing was done in Asia, perhaps in the maybe early 20th century, because this film also plays a lot with anachronistic time periods. It's unclear what's going on. And even though we know we're sort of moving from modern day Myanmar to Singapore and Bangkok, Saigon, and then to China, just how and when things occur and in what time period they're occurring in. And it's really like a wandering type of cinema. And I find that it's the director, as you mentioned, as you alluded to, Patrick, he created his own sort of found footage, which was then embedded in terms of telling of this story and playing with the reality of, I believe he got a DP who he referred to as an Oriental DP, which I thought was interesting in the press conference. But he got a DP who also has done the DP work for Apichapong to film some of the footage. And some of the footage that he has was also done while he was still in Portugal, because due to the COVID restrictions. And these had so many different extra layers of intrigue in terms of process, which also merit a revisiting of the film in another sense, because it's not even clear. I mean, I was completely captivated and also very unsure. But when he does talk about the process and then you watch it again, I'm sure that will bring something else.
Yeah, all this is very good. I think what one could gather from, interviews, and Gomesh said that his grand tour ended when he was about to enter a ferry or board a ferry to Shanghai. So the final stage of this grand tour was all like the images of nowadays China were then taken shot 2 years later and from afar, from Lisbon. And this also adds something to direct, you know, via Zoom or via video call. And I think the way, these non-fictional images are integrated here are we should say that there are so many parallels to the Xie Zhangqi film. It's incredible. They both, you know, base this work on a sort of archive that they have built, and they both integrate these non-fictional images and scenes as well. And here I also found one of the most striking images, and I'm sure it has struck a chord with you as well, is this Ferris wheel that is introduced at the beginning of the film, which is kept running only by the personnel there. So there are these workers. Yeah, what kind of place is that? It's a bit like a carnival, and this Ferris wheel is moved only by human effort. It's not, you know, it's not electrically geared. And to me, that was such an interesting motif, because the human initiative plays such a great role here, whereas the Edward character may well be taken from the Xie Zhangqi film in the sense that he's more or less floating. Molly, his fiancée, she is the one who takes the initiative. She is the one who goes on. And these carnival workers who keep spinning the Ferris wheel. To me, that also, because there is this colonial element of that as well. There are the tourists who step, into this Ferris wheel, and they depend on the labor of other people to have their entertainment. And I think I would like to read a piece on that element in the film as well. And as you both have alluded to, this colonial implications here, and whether the film glistens over them in some sort of nostalgia, or if it finds, you know, a way to deal with that productively. And to me, there is this danger of, I don't know, almost to over poeticize it. There was one more thing I wanted to say. Let's see. I think it had to do with the Xie Zhangqi film, but yeah, it doesn't come to mind right now. But yeah,
maybe before talking about the other films, I just wanted to add the idea of naivety and the discovery. I found really interesting, but at the same time, I feel like there's an anticlimactic aspect to it, because, you know, in the modernist narratives of early 20th century, of late 19th century, this, especially in literature, there's this Bildungsroman, right, where as an artist, a young person goes on a expedition, on a voyage, and things it's a male protagonist, sees and experiences new things, and it brings something to him. It kind of makes him more mature, and but like it's like a personal development. But here, as especially Edward, like he doesn't have any resolution, right? He like all the trips, all the travels he makes, it doesn't bring him anything. At least on a visible level, it doesn't contribute to his personal growth. And I also, there's a quote in the film, I think it's, I don't remember who says that, but it says like it's impossible for West to understand the Orient. And I think it kind of sums up the idea of the film, that all these trips and travels that our main character makes doesn't really bring anything to him, because there's a block that he's not unable to pass beyond that wall, this mental or maybe cultural block. And I think the idea of naivety is dealt with such a way that it's anticlimactic. At the end, it doesn't bring anything. So I think what Gomez does is he kind of spoils the idea of appropriation and also exploitation, because the Orient as a concept and experience doesn't really bring anything to our character. They just completely up far from each other.
Yeah, I mean, very quickly to just jump over that, I find that it's also somewhat beautiful to, if you say that you're going to establish the wall and you're not ever going to be able to penetrate or pierce past it, you can still imagine what is beyond the wall. And that in itself is how I also feel about this film, that it preserves that what is beyond the wall of exactly kind of what you just said.
Yeah, and there was this beautiful statement in the film that a shadow, you know, the shadow that it does not, what's the word? It does not obscure, but it reveals, actually. And we sort of see these little actions. I still think, to some extent, these actions, you know, they do make a difference in the film, and the film sort of insists on them as well, especially when it comes to the Molly character. Yeah, and the one thing I wanted to say, and then we can transition to the next film, is that many of the scenes were actually shot in the studio in Lisbon as well, which sort of, you know, ties into the idea that Gomesh recurs to the film's own construction, which, you know, we won't go into that, but there is a scene at the very end that also plays with that idea as well. Yeah, I think we all would recommend that movie, right? In any case, to me, really, perhaps the strongest film in competition, certainly one of them. And yeah, perhaps we go sort of hierarchically here. we might go to the Payal Kapadia, which, you know, won the second greatest prize at the festival. All We Imagine Is Light. That's her. Some call it a feature debut. Some are a bit more resistant towards that designation. Perhaps, Erky, could you give us a little introduction to All We Imagine Is Light?
I mean, it's interesting because when I think about the plot details of this film, it's such a small and simple story, and because it takes place in Mumbai. And it's about three women, we can say, I think. There's two nurses, Anu and Prabha, who also share an apartment. And Prabha is I think we can say that she's older and more mature than Anu. And she has an estranged husband who went to Germany and to whom she doesn't speak much and lost contact somehow. Anu, on the other hand, she's more cheerful, more easygoing. She's kind of disruptive, like chaotic as a character, I can say. But
and perhaps also more liberal, right?
Yeah, definitely. And Anu has a boyfriend who's Muslim, whereas she's Hindi, and her family tries to marry her, but she has a secret relationship with this Muslim boyfriend. One day, actually, Prabha receives a rice cooker from out of nowhere. And we assume that it's from her husband, but there's a supernatural and mysterious aspect of it that will come up in the second half of the film. And I think the first half and second half, we can just divide this film in a two-part thing because of the locations. And the first half resembles like a city symphony, I guess. I mean, it's such a reductive term, but I think it's kind of sums up for people who haven't seen the film, this idea of city having a character on its own. And there's also another worker in the hospital who's been kicked out of her house. And in the second half of the film, Prabha and Anu goes to her village to help her move out from the city to her village. But Anu has other motives to go to that village, and things happen. I think we can just sum up in this way, right?
Yes, no, I think that's a good summary. It was very, there's a simplicity about the plot, and it's in some sense something that we haven't not seen before, playing with the idea of from the city, the big city that's overcrowded, to a more a greener place or a more open space. But there's something so very, I mean, I found this film just very beautiful in that it was that which we had seen before, but there was just in the treatment of sexuality, nudity, gazing, etc. Well, we see a bare chest, but this is bared almost as a in such an interesting dynamic of trying to assert oneself, one's modernity, one's sexuality, but also it's not to another man, it's to another woman who is of an older generation, and it's not to be offensive, but it's just to just sort of state one's stance. And I found that these little subtle ways that the gaze was treated and the uniting of these women. There's another woman who's also sort of a squatter who's also dealing with some issues, and the way that they get together in some formation was very touching and simple. So, but it's true. There's a simplicity about it that it makes it hard actually for me to talk about it. I mean, we can talk about the music. The music also was this piano music that reminded me of the music of, I can't remember this woman's name who passed away recently, Emre. There's a song by her that I like quite much. It's just called Mother's Love, but I believe that the music was done by a different artist. Sorry, I've left us in a strange place.
No, can I add something about this? Because when we were talking about this recommendations to other people, right? And if somebody asked me why I recommend the swim, I don't have a proper train of thought to explain my reasoning, because I have images, I have sensibilities, I have colors that really affected me, the music, but it's so intangible, it's hard to talk about the disparate elements or in the film. I think that's what makes it difficult to talk about, because I mean, you were talking about the beauty, and that made me think about the beauty in cinema, and how, for example, Sorrentino is also obsessed with the beauty, and but how his beauty is always about the surface, the surface of the image, whereas, for example, in this film, it's the beauty inside things. It's inside. It's more inward looking beauty, and I think it's so hard to grasp this in an audiovisual language, and that's why I think we have difficulties expressing our admiration.
And yet I would say, to me, it's formally, I mean, the structure already hints at that, that's formally a diptych, right? We have this first, as you call it, a city symphony, Erku. And I think there one can see there it is, in a sense, also about, you know, the about appearances and about just sort of capturing the mundane. I think there, to me, what is evident is that it's often much more interesting to see a director who comes from non-narrative film to narrative film than the other way around, because you really get a sense here that she has an eye for these everyday actions. There's the way she introduces the hospital, which plays a central role at the beginning. I think there are a lot of shots that are just really piercing in the sense that they capture the overall atmosphere of that place. And same goes for Mumbai. I mean, we have these interview sections, it seems to me. I don't know if they are fictitious or not, but they seem to be, you know, more of an interview nature. And they discuss the place, Mumbai, what it means to them. At the same time, we have these tracking shots of street markets and the harbor and so on. So I feel like it is also about, you know, outer appearances and how she's able to get a grasp on them. And I do agree also that it is about the inner lives. And I think what I like, to me, it's not so difficult to recommend, because there is also this through line, this thematic through line of opening up a space, especially of female solidarity and female understanding, because while Anu and Prabha, while they do live together, I think we can take it that they have been living together for a while. It is only this place, you know, beyond Mumbai, that allows them to be open to each other and get a much deeper understanding of one another. And I think this alone makes for, you know, just on a thematic level, that alone makes for, you know, a story that I could easily recommend to a lot of people. But I think there's so much more. And I do think the way she captures spaces and opens up spaces is one of the things that especially struck a chord with me.
Can I add something about the documentary aspect? Because I thought of something quite different than what you said. I don't know if it's true. I don't know if you thought about like this as well, but you know, this for me, I kind of likened her treatment of the city to Wong Kar-wai's treatment of Hong Kong, because Hong Kong itself, there's a Wong Kar-wai of Hong Kong, right? From his camera, there's this filter or the style that kind of filters the city, and then you have this rendering. And I feel like Payal Kapadia also does that with this blue tint that covers the whole city. And I think there's a subjective aspect of city that kind of says us, this is not how truly city looks, but this is how I portray, this is how I give it to you. And I don't know, that maybe it's true, maybe not, but I kind of thought about Wong Kar-wai while watching the film, because it's kind of filmic construction.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's spot on. And I think this blue sort of encapsulates the entire city, right? Almost under its wrap. Is there something else we should mention, or should we transition?
No, we can transition to the next film.
Which is Sean Baker's Nora. His eighth feature film, the last one after Red Rocket, which perhaps might be my favorite of his. I've seen all his films, so I'm quite familiar with him as a filmmaker. To me, this one almost, so goes without saying, that's the Palme d'Or winner of this year. And to me, this almost means a departure in several ways. Of course, on a very fundamental level, he has changed to the distributor, which apparently hands out the Palme d'Ors as you know, just by signing up for them. So that's Neon's fifth Palme d'Or in a row, starting with Parasite, I think, in 2018. And yeah, to me, this is also a departure, just in the sense that usually Sean Baker's films are centered on, you know, on the disregarded, the people on the margins. And while you could say sort of the same thing about the central character here, who's Annie, the eponymous Nora, things are a bit different. The milieu is Brighton Beach in Brooklyn. It's a post, you know, like people from Soviet and post-Soviet times, they came to that part of New York, and it's sort of, you can think of it as, I think some people call it little, what is it? You know, like we have Little Italy, we have Chinatown, and there we have like a Little Russia or something in New York. And I think focusing so much on that milieu is quite different for Baker, which also comes at times at the expense of developing characters. But before I go too much into my assessment of the overall film, what is the premise? The premise is that we have the central character, Annie, who is a stripper, and she one day spots this good-looking young Slavic guy who communicates in broken English at the club she's working. And yeah, it turns out he's the son of a Russian oligarch, of a billionaire, and they spend more and more time together. He books her first for a date at home, and then they make a deal of her staying for longer, for a week, and there are even scenes when they negotiate her price, and at the end they end up marrying in Las Vegas. There is a sort of riff on the Pretty Woman narrative, But then it suddenly becomes a Safety Brothers film that is very anarchical, totally out of control, which is to a great part due to Mikey Madison's performance, who is really, the centerpiece of the film. Yeah, as with many of these Baker films that are, you know, deeply indebted to the tradition of social realism, there's this lurking doom from the beginning. I was also thinking of, you know, the Florida Project. It starts with that song by Kool and the Gang, Celebrations. So very uplifting. And we have NSYNC's Bye 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 in Red Rocket. And now we have a sort of remix version of Take That's Greatest Day, as we see these booties toward, you know, coming at us in, you know, in a close up in the club. And there, you know, the first line of that song, today, this could be the greatest day of our lives before it all ends, before we run out of time. So the doom is always, you know, inscribed in the film from the very beginning. And without giving away too much, one can sort of grasp where it all is headed towards. Yeah, Eliane, maybe could you tell us something about your initial responses and perhaps how you feel about it now, a week later?
Goodness. Thanks to you, you introduced me to Sean Baker's work, and I'm also very much a big fan in general of his work. I found Anora to be a film that I did laugh a lot in, but there was something about it that did not really strike the right chord for me. Perhaps I had too high expectations, but I felt in some sense there were some shortcuts that were taken, and there were a lot of stereotypes and baboonery that I feel was not always present, even though it did bring levity to this work. And I think perhaps I thought that I was going to see something slightly different. And for me, the heart was slightly lost of this character of Anur, of Ani. I think performances were incredible. For me, Ivan Vanya, who played by Mark Eidelstein, was also such a roar, along with his longtime collaborator, Karen Karagulian, who's been in almost every single one of his films, going back from Takeout to Prince of Broadway, Tangerine, I guess Florida Project as well, maybe even Red Rocket. It was nice to see that Baker nodded to all of his entire filmography. And I'm not one to normally think about plot and et cetera, but I did have a hard time believing some points. I don't know if I will go into them in terms of what would so-called be the choice or what is believable for Ani to do. But I do really appreciate the way that language was treated. She takes on this Brooklyn accent. Mikey Madison takes on this Brooklyn accent. And there's so much in terms of understanding what she understands in terms of her Russian abilities as she communicates with the character of Vanya, and how Vanya, whose father is a billionaire, who knows? We don't really know what he does. We just know, oh, that's your father. Wow. And he has a set of henchmen or right-hand men who are Armenian and Russian as well, who help him do his work. There's in a modern fairy tale like way, a marriage occurs that needs to be annulled, and it's through this that the comedy ensues. And I still am having difficulty digesting this film, because it's a very fun and pleasurable watch, but I think there's something for me that was missing, and I sort of feel sad about that. But I do feel very happy that Baker and his when I think of Baker getting the Palme d'Or for this film, I think of it as his filmography and his work and his process, which often involves a lot of scouting, a lot of looking for those people who are locals and unknown who appear in his films, the way that he does support sex workers and that he does have a very generous and very open view of what should be done in terms of seeing people and allowing their locales to be filmed and to try to make them as real as possible. And I think that that is the most admirable part of what Baker stands for and how, in a sense, he realizes very much that while he is the director, all that he makes comes about with the collaboration and very close collaboration with those who he shoots, the communities that he enters. And I don't know, I was wondering how you found the film, Vicky.
I also think that when a director wins a Palme d'Or, I think it's never the film that wins the award, but his previous films or his own previous work that kind of finally gets a recognition. And I think it's the same with Sean Baker and Anora. I also enjoyed watching this film a lot. And while watching it, I kept thinking of how balanced the humorous and the dramatic aspects are put in the film. And I think since you mentioned Safdie Brothers, the reason I like their films, especially Uncut Gems and Good Time, is that this balance between the really crowd pleaser mainstream things, but put in such a way that it creates a artsy film. And I think it's quite present in Tony Erdmann. This humorous aspect in I think art house films intrigue me a lot, and that's why I mean art house is a diminutive term. I don't like it, but it's maybe like a festival films, let's say. But I also, while watching it, you become conscious of the structure and you appreciate it a lot from a distance. So while watching it, I kept thinking about how balanced the narrative is in that sense. But as you said, I also think, looking back after 1 week later, I think there are some problems with the character construction, especially with Annie, because the moment when we first meet her, she's so self-contained and she protects herself from the outside world. And I think she kind of opens up to this young man, but the way the transition is made is not really well structured, because the Annie we met at the beginning of the film is not the same Annie who trusts and tries to save the marriage. I think the first Annie would just say, okay, fuck you, I don't care, and would walk away. But then there's an inconsistencies between these moments. Maybe that's also what kind of bothered you in terms of narrative that you didn't want to mention a lot. But at the same time, this central piece that happens in the house is so energetic and so dynamic, it's so, but at the same time, I mean, it feels chaotic, but everything is scripted, right? And it's so hard to reflect this chaos that and make it believable. It's actually not spontaneous, but it's written, right? And I think that's one of the biggest biggest points of the film. I think we talked about this when we were at the train station, how the Annie's character is her relationship with Igor is treated and near the end. And I think it's also,
which I love the name, it's so funny, Igor and Igor. But sorry to interrupt.
I don't know. So that was also an interesting maybe aspect that we can talk about. But the actor, I think his name is Yuri.
Yuri Borisov, yeah.
He's such a talented actor. And I think it was also one of the performances that really stood out in the film. Vanya had this Dominic Sessa chaotic energy that I wasn't really convinced to. But Yuri, on the other hand, I like his performance a lot. He was amazing in compartment number 6. Petrov, not Petrov, but What was that film about?
He was in Petrov's Flu.
Also, another one, another Russian film. It was in Venice, I think.
Oh, there. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, so he's just really good, and I think he understood quite a lot the assignment. But about the stereotypes, I was wondering if it was like a self-consciously playing with these, because these people also have stereotypes regarding mm-hmm. each other, right? Like, oh, you Russian oligarch, oh, you stripper. So I think he was also trying to play with these stereotypes through the characters, through their perceptions of each other. But at the same time, I kind of believe that there's a really surface level humor about Armenians, Russians. Yes, that's also true. Well, still, he tries to play with them, but I think it kind of stays on the surface level.
But to me, I will still say that this was just in terms of, I don't know, cinematic accomplishment. I think that was clearly one of the standouts of the competition, for me at least. I think from the very first scene, you're taken into that world. And I think Sean Baker, he does have a sort of signature, and you understand that this is a Sean Baker film, which to me is most tangible in the sort of epilogue of that scene, of that film, that many people I spoke to found very touching. I don't know how you felt about it, but I think there he shows that he's not the Safdie brothers, but he's also interested in something else that, you know, in their film perhaps is at times lacking to me. What I wanted to say, maybe perhaps to give some background on, perhaps I'm theorizing here too much, but to me, this is also perhaps a film that lets him do other projects in the future, because I think with the Palme d'Or now, but also just with the commercial viability, which this film clearly has more of than his previous films, you know, he gets closer to his project that he wanted to do since he did the Florida Project. So after the Florida Project, he moved to Vancouver and worked on a film for which he was to be given $12 million, which he often claimed would be, you know, the threshold at which you still have director's cut. So you still have all creative liberties or freedom. But due to COVID, this didn't come to pass. And then he had to do these small films, Red Rocket, and now this one, which also doesn't, I think it doesn't have an enormous budget. But I think he's thinking of this project, which I think was about decriminalization of drug users in Vancouver. So he had been working on that, and then this project was canceled and he had to deal with it and come up with new creative avenues. And I think this perhaps, you know, gets him back on the radar of bigger studios, and maybe he will be able to follow his passion project. And I found interesting what you said about the perhaps inconsistencies of Annie. I can see that, but I can also see that this is sort of where this through line of Sean Baker's career, the American dream, comes in. Because once Annie is intoxicated with the idea that this could be, you know, her greatest day, this could be a way of securing her lifelong finances by just marrying this guy, it's too good to be true, maybe, but I think she just takes the bait there, and she is intoxicated by that idea, which she then is not able to backtrack from.
Interesting. I think for me, maybe I'm just living in a different version of cynicism, but I found it also very difficult to imagine, because in some sense I saw, this is not really how to see it, but there was a nod to the Florida Project, and just the idea that Annie has this dream to have her honeymoon at Disneyland or Disney World, and sometimes I'm confused between the two. But the cynicism in me did not allow me to still believe that this woman would have such an aspiration and such such a dream. And I feel like that's really, I don't know, that's probably more on me. It's intriguing that it came across for you, but oof, I don't know. And also in terms of the epilogue, the introduction of something that I feel like we haven't yet seen in a baker was the fact that there's a chivalrous aspect to it. And I think you can interpret it in other ways too, but I was not ready to see this. And I think it's something that, of course, there are many different layers to it. But for me, the two elements that really arise are, can we... it's so difficult. It's so difficult in terms of understanding her as a woman and how she's received and how she is given some form of agency or how she is perceived or, and something I really still can't put my finger on it, but there's something that felt more like she was being received and she was being somewhat saved and that we didn't enter that space. It's called Honora. The film is called Honora. But for me, everyone around her was more present than she was. And that also can play a very big part in, that could be a reality for sure. The other thing that comes up with being like, okay, with Baker's filmography, can one also be so in a community that you can once again start making fun within that community and playing to the stereotypes, playing to the jokes? This is a bit going back to the thing that we talked about earlier. But yeah, please. Thank you.
I hear you. I hear you, what you're saying about the ending. And I think it's what he tries to do is to create an equality between these two characters and kind of like a non-spoken understanding of saying, I see you, I understand you. But of course, there's this gender dimension that comes into play. And it's kind of, I think, what, as you were saying, the chivalry, it becomes more like as if he's trying to console her and then like, and... Yeah, I understand. But what I maybe wanted to have was this also equal mutual understanding of being an outcast in a given cultural and political context in America. I see you. But at the same time, what I liked is more is that these characters are, I mean, Annie is not super, she's not suffering, right? And her being a sex worker is never... explained through the poverty or whatever. She's a sex worker and that's her reality. Mm-hmm. We don't know about her family. Maybe they live in Florida, but it's never presented as a obligation or like because she is poor or because she's something that mm-hmm. she does sex work. No, she's a sex worker and that's all. And I think this kind of, yeah, not being completely dependent to your background, but still being affected by it was interesting because I think the other guy, Russian one, is also like he's living with his grandmother. He's okay. It's like a, I mean, he's not in a, like we couldn't say like a, we couldn't qualify them as like a poor people, but they're still affected by their backgrounds. And I think this impact is mutual. And what the, especially the last part was trying, what tries to do is to connect these souls through these mutual experiences of not being a wasp.
Yeah, and perhaps also... one of the late reveals then in this sort of epilogue is that the guy played by Yuri Borisov, Igor, that he is not the guy she thought he would be. But she insists so strongly that he is this guy that she pictured in her head that it's sort of, yeah, she's deeply irritated by that and does things that psychologically very interesting, I think. I will say, well, you can... well, you can argue that the sort of depiction of this milieu, this Russian post-Soviet milieu in New York, is perhaps not well enough explored. I do think that it's just refreshing to see, you know, to be seeing New York in a way that, you know, refrains from these obvious images that we all have of New York. I think we see some new places there, or like places that we don't encounter that often in cinema.
Yeah, the Armenian baptism was quite funny in terms of seeing places that we don't normally see.
Oh yeah, and you know, speaking of Armenian, there is this great monologue of the Armenian guy who's in this primarily Russian or Armenian speaking restaurant that really exists there in Coney Island. And he has this, yeah, great monologue about the younger generation, you know, that is only on TikTok and Instagram and only concerned with their screens. And I even saw like a thematic through line there, because the way Baker captures Las Vegas earlier in the film sort of attributes to that. We see Las Vegas only in sort of TikTok videos, you know, like short snippets. We have these fake fireworks that are projected onto the ceiling of the shopping malls and the casinos. And they, you know, it's a great montage where each sequence only lasts a few seconds or so. And I feel like first Baker throws us into that world, and then later we have this old man who's sort of complaining about it. So I found that funny as well.
Yeah, no, I think that this film, I can see it also becoming a bit of a classic in the years to come, regardless of how I feel about it right now. And I do think that there's a lot there to explore and just to appreciate, either from a technical standpoint or however it is from performance standpoint, and just seeing Baker rise and be able to get the budgets. Hopefully in the future, he'll be able to achieve these projects that you mentioned. For me, Red Rocket was also really like, wow, you have America by the balls. You know exactly how to depict America. And same with Florida Project and Takeout and Prince of Broadway. Just these like little snippets into something that felt very real. And perhaps this, because it's true, humor is real, as he said in his press conference, which is something. And even this idea that maybe we need to have some form of, I don't know, depth or character development, it's not something that we necessarily see in reality. So to play my own devil's advocate, I feel this film is not there necessarily to provide those things or to provide the answers to those things. And it's also sometimes perhaps even tiring that stories sometimes need this depth and profundity in order for people to feel like it resonates with them. So I don't mean it as a backhanded compliment, but in some sense, there's another element that can be appreciated in how it doesn't aim to do that. It aims to sort of like bring people back into the cinema overall.
Yeah, I what I was going to say was about the audience, because I think what this film really succeeds is to create a bigger audience about, but not diminishing its qualities, not its strong aspect. It's like it's a crowd pleaser for sure, but it doesn't affect its quality. And I think it's really hard to create this thing. For example, I mean, it's a complete different register, but like, for example, Hamaguchi's Drive My Car was a good example of that, like being awarded by Oscar and being watched by so many people and still being a strong film. And I mean, it's of course a more capitalistic mindset of being like appealing to everyone. But at the same time, I think Sean Baker he's aware of where he stands in the industry, and that this is also a product, and it's crafted by so many people, and it has to create an appeal. And I think it's if you think about the rules of the game, he knows how to play it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and also, you know, just on a very egoistic level, I would wish for him to just continue, you know, on this low tier budget, because I think it might make for more interesting films. I'm concerned about the compromises he might have to accept in films that have a bigger budget. But of course, you know, like as someone who's been following him for so many years, it was also just such a pleasure to see him, you know, get this mm-hmm. biggest recognition that, as he said himself, he's been working on for 30 years or so. But yeah, maybe we should wrap up here. A last question to you two guys. Erku, whom would you have awarded if you had been, who is the jury president this year? Greta Gerwig, right?
Yeah.
If you had been her, Erku.
I think I'd go with Kapadia.
I would second that, even though I think I might like The Grand Tour by Gomesh a little bit more than Kapadia. It's a very different type of film, but I don't know. Maybe the energy and the beauty and the blue and the... It reached me.
Yeah.
It reached me.
I would co-sign that too. You know, having been on this jury this year for the Fipreski, there is this concern always about, you know, which award helps the filmmaker as well, mm-hmm. you know, for their future endeavors. And there would have been an even stronger chance for her to secure future projects, but I think she'll be all right with the Grand Jury Prize as well. And you know, that was only her second film. Like the first film was got an award for the best documentary at Cannes. Now she got the Grand Jury Prize, so I think her future is bright. Yeah, and this I think leads us to the end of the episode. Erku, thank you so much for joining us today.
I thank you. It was such a rich and nice conversation. I feel like I finally got the chance to talk about Cannes in a more productive way. And, you know, it's when we do podcasts, I feel like it's also giving something, sharing, and not just consuming, watching 40 films a day. So I think it's being generous to each other when we talk about the films and finding time to discuss. I think it's really important, and I really appreciate it for giving me this chance.
Thank you.
As we often do, for those who want to find your work in the three different languages that you've written them in terms of con coverage, where can they find you?
Okay. I usually write for Altiazi and Film Explorer, Soho Ciné, which is a French feminist media. And I also started writing for In Review Online. So you can find me on different film criticism media, but there's a link, tr.ee, on my profile on Instagram and Twitter. So you can find everything you look for there, basically.
Well, thank you so much again for joining us.
Yeah, fantastic. And as a reminder, our next regular episode will be on Dario Meju's The Cow. We will be looking forward to that one as well. Yeah, goodbye. Thank you, Erku.
Ciao, ciao. Bye.
Bye.